Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Mm-hmm. No spot dice. I've got some no spot dice here, and I'm going to roll them, and you're just going to trust me.
Oh, yeah. Sure, Big Jules.
Heck yeah. This is episode number 130, and we're going to talk about Guys and Dolls, starring Marlon Brando and Frank Sinatra.
Yes.
Or is it Sinatra and Brando?
I don't think so. You told me, I really love Frank Sinatra so much, and I'm like, well, he was in it. But I chose this because I fell in love with Marlon Brando watching this
one. That's too funny. That's too funny.
Like, I just loved him, despite the singing and acting skills or lack thereof.
Despite those two things,
well, poor
he
guy.
Was fantastic.
He evidently tried so hard. I mean, he took lessons. He did 20 takes on stuff.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Yeah. And they'd still wind up for songs like pulling the best bits of like 20 different takes to put together for one.
Oh, really?
Huh. Yeah, poor thing. He said he thought he had a voice like a yak, and admittedly it was quite weak, but since we don't hear all those 20 takes, we're good.
That's so odd. You know, why cast him?
Because, for one thing, he and the director, Joseph Mankiewicz, I think this might be how you say it, had worked together and really liked each other. And they had just worked on a Shakespearean movie, maybe Julius Caesar, right before that.
Huh,
and
cool.
Also, the studio, he was hot property at the time. And the studio knew that people would be curious to see him dance and sing. And somebody who's got such a serious set of movies do something like this. So he was a huge box office draw for them because he'd also done On the Waterfront the year before.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, which is, you know, heavy duty.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then to think of him doing this.
Huh. Well, that's cool.
Yeah.
It's neat that he worked so hard on it, you know, cause I have a Marlon Brando reputation in my head of being a very difficult person. And for him to work that hard on something like this goes against what I think I know about him.
Well, exactly. And what's interesting, and I'll just tell this story now and get it out of the way, I guess, is that he came on board really into it, like, okay, I'm going to do my very best. And he went to Frank Sinatra and said, let's work on this together because this is your area and I know you can help me with it. And Frank Sinatra was totally pissed off about the whole thing because, for one thing, he called Brando Mumbles. He started off doing it behind his back, but not so much toward the end of the shooting. And then he had signed on and not realized he didn't have the main role. Then he got really pissed because he had also been up for On the Waterfront and lost it to Marlon Brando, which I think
that was probably the best thing.
Agreed. I mean, I get that he could act, but that needed somebody different than him. He, for one thing, he was too old. But the other thing is, so he totally rejected him. And Marlon Brando's like, fine. So very quickly, the crew is taking sides. And they also have very different working styles, which is Marlon Brando was the method actor. So every time he did a take, he would find more in the character. And the director was obviously comfortable with this since he'd worked with him. Well, Frank Sinatra was really well known for feeling like maybe two takes. It all should be spontaneous. And then that's the most genuine thing, and that's done. And especially later in his movie career, he would just tell the directors, no, we're done. That was good. And walk off.
Oh,
wow. So he had these two very determined temperamental people. And so what happened is Marlon Brando would start tweaking Frank Sinatra during takes. And so the most famous story is that scene in Mindy's where they're having Frank Sinatra's eating cheesecake, trying to get Skye Masterson, who Marlon Brando, to take the bet on cheesecake or strudel. Which one do they sell more of? And he's eating this piece of cheesecake. Well, every time they'd get toward the end of the take, and Marlon Brando would deliberately flub a line. Well, when they started over, Frank Sinatra had to start on a new piece of cheesecake. So they get to, let's see, where I have this written down. It's, and the thing is he was doing each scene better and better and better.
Brando or Sinatra?
Brando.
Okay, Brando. Okay.
Because that's Brando's style, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And plus he's just enjoying the heck out of it, I'm sure. So it says, after 8 takes, he was feeling nauseated. And then when the 9th attempt was scrapped, he threw his plate on the ground, jammed his fork in the table, and screamed at the director, "These effing New York actors, how much cheesecake do you think I can eat?"
Stop it. Oh my gosh.
Whereas Mankiewicz was so happy with what Brando was doing that he wound up, toward the end of shooting, he gave him like a, gosh, I can't remember, it was a white Cadillac or a convertible or something, really great car.
Wow.
Brando loved, and because Brando loved it so much and he was having such a great experience in general, he did a few promotional appearances for the movie, which he would never do, being temperamental, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. But you know, there was another thing that caused conflict, which we can talk about when we're talking about the movie.
Wow.
So he came away unhappy also with the director, but yeah.
Fascinating. Yeah. You know, you remember The Godfather, you know, Brando and The Godfather, mm-hmm. but wasn't the, there was a singer in The Godfather, and wasn't that kind of patterned on Sinatra? You remember the singer that The Godfather helped?
And I don't remember.
And
I've only
was
seen
kind
it
of, I mean, that gives that a whole new dimension because, you know, just even knowing that these two know yeah. each other, because yeah. the singer was kind of a, you know, he'd go to the Godfather and say, you know, this guy won't give me this part and I know it's the perfect part for me and I don't know why they won't give it to me. And then that's where, that's what the head and the guy's bed was all about, that horse head.
Okay. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does make you look at it differently.
It does, yeah. Because I always felt that that was sort of a Sinatra,
yes.
you know, it was patterned on Sinatra, role. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it's all this stuff where I realized thinking about that, and I realized we're kind of doing it backwards where we haven't talked about the movie really, but when I was watching this and thinking about their conflicts behind the scenes, they don't really have very many parts together in this movie because the movie was made, the original Broadway musical was made from 2 Damon Runyon stories that were kind of melded together. And so that's where you see you have the Nathan Detroit and Miss Adelaide story and the floating crap game.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the Sarah Brown story with Skye Masterson.
Interesting. So that was 2 stories from Damon Runyon. I didn't know that either. How cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's why the dialogue is, sorry, can you tell I've done movie talks about this? But that's why they talk in that real stilted way. I do not think I'm going to go do this now because they would always, there were no contractions.
Yeah, yeah.
Used and that kind of thing. And that was how he wrote the dialogue in his stories. He was almost, have you read his stories at all?
No, nothing leaps to mind. Not that I'm aware.
I have a long time ago, and this made me think I should reread some because what he did was he traveled around. He was a journalist and he would hang out with all these seedy characters, but he knew that he needed to kind of, make things a little more cheerful, maybe, than their real lives might be. So in a way, he made me think of O. Henry, you know, because the stories were funny in unexpected ways sometimes, or they would turn on some twist that was just out of the blue, which I guess is what I just said.
So they were not super serious stories. They were...
Well, sometimes they were.
Okay.
You know, but they were always patterned after real people. when I was looking at his Wikipedia page yesterday, just briefly, and they were saying, for example, that, you know, like this character who shows up in several, Harry the Horse was patterned after this person and that sort of thing.
Hmm. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. So somebody liked the stories and said, let's put them into a musical. And this might be the one where they did all the songs and had part of the musical done, and then the writer pulled out. It was a woman, and she just went, I'm not doing this. And then they had all these songs, but no musical to go with it. So then they had to sit down and write the musical to go with those songs, write the story part.
That's interesting. And then that's when they figured out, oh, let's do these two stories. And
well, I think they already kind of wanted to do those two stories, okay. But they didn't have, how are they meshing together?
Okay.
How do they get involved with each other? What happens with these people? You know, the dialogue, and how does the plot unroll for each one, and sort of thing. And then, you know, it was turned into a, it was fabulously successful, and then turned into this musical on for, you know.
For Broadway, yeah. Movies. Yeah, so I assume it was on Broadway, and then they made this movie after it was a success on Broadway.
Yeah, it was very successful.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and still making the runs around. I still see that every now and then at a community theater or even running.
Right?
Yeah, I played Big Julie.
Yeah.
There's no spot dice. If it gets around in Chicago that I went to a prayer meeting, no decent person will talk to me.
Yeah. Don't you tell anyone.
Yeah.
Well, so then let me ask you, because I haven't found anybody yet who's actually seen a musical production, and they're always a bit different than a movie.
Sure, yeah.
Do you like one more than the other? Do you, because there's some different songs.
Yeah, there's some different songs and things, but, you know, when you're, especially in the role that I had on this one, you know, when I do the tech part, you know, when I'm doing lights and sound, I see the whole thing multiple times. But being in it, I don't see it like that. So I couldn't even tell you how similar it was other than the parts I was in.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So normally, though, when, you know, the differences are the setting, you know, there you can have more sets and stuff when you're doing the movie version. You're not, you know, trying to be economical, saying we need to do as many things in the mission as we can. And, you know, have as few sets as possible type of a thing. But I can't say that I saw, you know, I enjoyed the movie a great deal. So there's really nothing that I saw contradicted anything that I did.
Okay.
If that makes any sense. But
yeah, well, and the musical, I guess we've talked all about it, but in some terms. But so the musical, though, the way it's shown is so great. It's so great looking. It's highly stylized.
Yeah.
And the director had said he wanted real characterizations from the people, but he didn't care about the rest of it could be very stylized. So he kind of let the production designer have their head.
Yeah.
And also I think it was Michael Kidd, that real famous choreographer, got to do all the choreography for it.
Yeah, and it looked in that way like a stage production. You know, the sets that they used looked like they could have been on a stage.
Yeah, they were just glitzier than you'd expect in
cases. Yeah, and not totally realistic, you know, just like you said, stylized backdrops and things rather than, you know, we're in a real city.
Yeah, because when there's a crap game that's down in the sewers, I was just watching it this time, just admiring so much the set design of, you know, here's all the cords and things that you know are going to come down, like power lines and stuff, but each one was a different color and the way they were swooping around. And I'm like, man, this looks good.
I remember us, you know, our theater, we had pipes running all over the place and it was cool too. It was, you know, everybody does their own version of that, but that's, you know, it wasn't unlike that at all.
Mm-hmm. It gives you that, I guess it gives a production designer that scope to really play with it and have fun with it.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, and the, and it's set in New York, so there's that feel because of Times Square and all that. But, and then the costuming, something I was looking at pointed out that that's really stylized, but what they did is a mashup is the men's costumes tend to play off of 1920s styles, and the women's are all very definitely 1950s styles, and this was done in 1955. And so especially like in, what was it called, the Kit Kat Club or whatever, where Miss Adelaide would do her shows, you know, that was where you could really see some of the 1950s ideas for stuff.
Sure,
so.
Sure.
Anyway, but so, should I give a brief description?
Yeah, let's do it.
So basically this is all set among the people who skim the surface of criminality. I guess the cops are always kind of chasing them, but they're doing things like they're betting, they're running numbers, they're doing crap game, floating crap games. And that's Nathan Detroit. He's famous for his floating crap game that goes all over the city.
Right, which he's been doing since he was a juvenile delinquent.
Yeah, since he was 12 or something.
That made me laugh.
Yeah, and so what you've got is all these small-time hoods who are just glorying in the way they're playing the roles, you can see with the accents and that kind of thing. And but Nathan Detroit is being watched so closely by this one detective that he can't find a good place to do the crap game or everybody will get arrested. And everybody knows it, so they're not letting him have the venues that he would normally have. One place would, if he'd give him $1,000, and he finds out Sky Masterson is in town, who's played by Nathan Detroit is Frank Sinatra, Sky Masterson, because he's such a high player. He's the top of the line kind of gambler. And that's Marlon Brando. And so he knows that he can do a high dollar bet, and he tries to lure him into a bet that doesn't work. Sky Masterson eludes it. But then he says, he's talking about dolls, Sky is. And, you know, I was in Vegas. I loved that. I was in Vegas and it was perfect because the dolls all had like great, they all had all their teeth or great teeth and no last names.
Right.
Because one doll is like another. And so Nathan Detroit says, I bet that you can't get a doll I pick to go with you to Havana tomorrow to have lunch or whatever, dinner or whatever he said he was going to do. And he goes, okay. And so he picks Sarah Brown, who is the head of a Salvation Army type gospel group or mission type group. And they're out there trying to win the sinners off the streets and failing abysmally. And Sky Masterson's like, oh, I've been had, I'm a chump. But he is going to do it. He's going to try and win the bet. So that brings him and Sarah Brown together. And Sarah Brown is rightfully suspicious. And so he's pursuing her to try and get her to go to Havana. And then you have to go with Nathan Detroit. You have Miss Adelaide, who he has been engaged to for 14 years. And she's just dying to get married. Everything she says to him kind of winds back around. Oh, I don't mind that you didn't get me an anniversary present. It's almost like we were married, you know, everything. And she's desperate. And she's so upset by all of it that she has a psychosomatic cold that will never go away. And so she's busy trying to angle and get him to marry her, and not through any underhanded means. She's just like, I love you. Why aren't we getting married? You promised me you would get a real job and go on the up and up. And he's like, yeah, sure, baby. Yeah, right. Because he's trying to figure out still where to have his crap game.
Right. Yep.
And so that sets up the two couples and their problems and the reason that they're linked together.
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes the way of all musicals. There are problems, there are romances, there are, you know, betrayals and entanglements, and many wonderful songs.
And lots of songs, yeah.
Glorious, glorious dancing, too.
Agreed, yeah. They did a fantastic job with something else.
Oh, yeah, Luck Be a Lady Tonight is all done as a ballet, where it's a huge floating crap game. Well, right before that. And they said the director's like ballet. And he saw it and went, okay, yeah, that works.
Yeah, and that's a funny thing, too. You know, Luck Be a Lady Tonight is something that I always hear Sinatra sing. You know, and here it's Marlon Brando. And then to know that they were, you know, fighting each other. And not only that, but the song has a whole other dimension when you see it in the context.
Yes, mm-hmm. because he, and what attracted me to this movie is I was watching it, as I said, to do a movie discussion group, but I was so stunned by the center of the relationship between Skye Masterson and Sarah Brown, because she is a Salvation Army type. There's some other name, but I'm just going to call it that because that's clearly what it's based on.
Yeah.
It all turns on repentance, sin, prejudging other people, how there are depths that you don't understand in people. And when the Lady Luck song comes up, he starts off saying, okay, well, I'm going to say, while I'm waiting for you guys to get your markers written, I'm going to say a prayer. And then he sings Luck Be a Lady Tonight. I'm like, that's so different than the Skye Masterson we see. I mean, it's not a classic prayer, but he's essentially saying a prayer.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
And it's so different than the Skye Masterson that we see in The Mission, who can quote chapter, line, and verse of the Bible, because the only thing that's been in as many hotel rooms as he has is the Gideon Bible.
Right.
And so he's read it a dozen times.
Yeah, yep. That's cool. And that scene that you're talking about there is just fantastic. I wonder how many times they did that.
Which one?
The Luck Be a Lady. The one in The Mission. No, the one in The Mission.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, because that dialogue is just snapping
it's
back and
forth. It's unbelievable. Yeah, just bam. Yeah.
Yeah.
Really impressive. Well, and Gene Simmons was fantastic, too.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, she really did great.
And she was another one that they wouldn't have considered her because she wasn't a singer.
Hmm.
And she sent in a tape and they went, she had such a fresh, natural voice that it worked. Uh-huh. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And whereas the Miss, and it's funny the way that they're paired up, it's actually perfect because Miss Adelaide is the one who originated the role on Broadway.
Oh.
And they thought of other people, but everybody fell through.
Hmm.
And so they wound up using her.
Yeah.
And she and Frank Sinatra are really they're kind of the old school classical musical, Broadway musical type couple in their songs and the way they act with each other and present themselves. And then you've got the two people who are really originally actually actors. And that's, of course, Marlon Brando and Gene Simmons. And their relationship has a completely different feel because they are singing and dancing, but they're primarily acting.
Yeah, yeah.
And so to me, their relationship felt much more interesting and genuine than the Miss Adelaide and Frank Sinatra one.
Sure,
you may not have felt that way.
No, I did feel that way. You know, when I think about what this movie's about, it's really, to me, about Skye and Sarah Brown.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what I remember about it. You know, Nathan Detroit is, you know, he's a character. He's not the lead character, but he was always funny, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then Miss Adelaide was always really just comical.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Right?
That song about a person can develop a cold.
Yeah.
It's
right,
so funny.
Right. So I found him funny, right? But when mm-hmm. When I remember this, I remember Skye Masterson and Sarah Brown.
Yeah.
Because that's where the depth is, really.
Yeah. You
know, the depth,
well, and that's why Frank Sinatra was mad when he read the script.
Oh, really? He's like,
well, that's
horrible. Yeah, I want to
be that. Yeah, because he was like, what? I signed on for Nathan Detroit,
mm-hmm.
but I should be Skye Masterson.
Hmm. That wouldn't have worked out as well.
No,
you know, he that wasn't the kind of actor he was. He was in the right role. Interesting. It's funny.
Mm-hmm.
People are funny.
Well, he, you know, it was about who got the main role for him. And, you know, he was no Brando. I mean, just like Brando was no Sinatra. No one, he couldn't sing those songs as well as a regular singer. And I know when I first saw this movie and I was writing about it on Happy Catholic, and I mean, all these people were piling in going, no. You've never seen this done by a proper Broadway set of people. The singing could have been so much more. And I'm like, but I loved Skye Masterson anyway. It didn't matter that his singing was weak. Yeah, I got that the singing was weak. But the acting that went with the singing was so superior. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
To me, it worked.
It worked great. Yeah. Yeah, I thought they were both good. I've had all four of them. I really enjoyed all four of them.
Yeah, they were all perfect.
Yeah.
Well, the other bit of trivia, and then maybe I think I'm out, but Frank Sinatra, there are a couple songs that he sings as ballads that aren't supposed to be ballads. They're supposed to be funny songs or funnier. And he's singing them with Miss Adelaide. And he deliberately did that and made the orchestra slow down with him and all this stuff. And Marlon Brando got so pissed off. He went to the director and said, look, you've got to make him sing these the way they should be. There can only be one romantic lead in the movie. And I'm sure by that time, the director's like, I am so freaking beat down. Leave me alone. He's like, I'm just handling it. And he goes, well, be a director. You know, and he's like, I'm directing the way I want. And he goes, well, fine. I'm never going to be in another movie with you.
Oh, really? Wow.
And he didn't.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Jeez.
So this is this poor Joseph Mankiewicz. I can't believe he got this great movie out of all these conflicts.
Wow. That's something. You know, you hear stuff behind the scenes, you know, like in Star Trek and stuff that's similar, you know, between Shatner and Nimoy.
Oh, yeah.
Just like, oh, come on.
I know, you guys, because now does it matter?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I'm trying to think of the songs that you're even mentioning, you know, because I haven't, you know, I haven't seen this done on stage other than when we did it, you know, and I couldn't even say I've seen the whole thing, like I said. So, but I remember, you know, our actor doing Nathan Detroit, and maybe he patterned it after Sinatra. You know, usually, you know, we had two kinds of directors. Ones that wanted to recreate exactly what people knew, right? So they would say, all right, everybody go watch the movie. You know, or something like that. And then you'd have directors that, I don't want you watching anything, you know.
You start
from, you know, what you know, and let me try to create this.
Right.
You know, so.
Right. Well, the only one I can think of right at the moment was there, that I think probably should have been funnier was, and I could be wrong, but there's one where they're all getting ready to go to the mission. They're all coming down and they've got their red carnations on, and Miss Adelaide's waiting for Frank Sinatra because they were supposed to have gone off and eloped that night.
Oh, yeah.
So she's really furious at him. And they're singing a song back and forth to each other.
Mm.
And she's always singing it a bit comically. And he's always, Adelaide, you know.
Oh,
and
Yeah,
and he's slowing it way down, going, no, I'm really serious. And maybe it was supposed to
be. Yeah, I can totally see what you're saying right there, for sure.
But the tone felt like he could have sung those songs with the sincere words just in a slightly different, you know, in a more comic tone, and it would have suited her better.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but it, you know, it was fine the way it was, but.
Yeah, and he was really good at the funny stuff. You know, you remember when he said something about, you know, what's playing at the Roxy?
Yeah.
I'll tell you what's playing at the Roxy, you know, and then he gets that sentence out.
I love that song so much.
You know, that was fantastic.
Yeah, that was all about why is a guy doing anything? It's because of a doll.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, that's and those first scenes that set up all that stuff were so great.
Yeah, yeah. And he was definitely, you know, that quick patter. I mean, he had all that, so.
Oh, yeah, he could do all that stuff. But, you know, it's in a sense, I guess, so this, even though this isn't why I picked the movie, but it comes down to, are you going to be obedient to the director who might know more what would be better off? Or are you going to insist on doing it your way? Which is a huge battle, of course, that I have in my own life.
Yeah, yeah.
With a lot of people, not just God.
Well, shoot, I remember, I think it was Orson Scott Card, if I remember right. He was saying that theater is an actor's medium. And movies are a director's medium. It's almost like, you know, who has the last say, right? It's the director and the editor or who are picking, you know, and you can do so many takes. But in the theater, you're live. And although the director has set up the possibility for success, it's really up to that live performance.
Mm-hmm.
From that actor.
So in that case, we're all in the theater of our lives, essentially.
I guess so, yeah. And the actor can make choices on stage, sometimes unexpectedly, you know, that can't be corrected. You know, I mean, if the director would want to correct them, right?
Right.
It would be like, you know, but that's the medium in which they can flex.
Yeah, they could try it for another performance, but not for that one.
Exactly.
That's done.
Yeah.
Well, what I've been doing a lot of talking about stuff, and we haven't talked about the mission, but what about you? I mean, do you have anything that really struck you?
Well, what struck me, you know, this time through, you know, and again, I was always familiar with it. But when I watched it, I was really surprised at the depth of the story between Sarah and Sky.
Yeah.
Especially that scene that I mentioned when he goes into the mission, and you know, there's some funny stuff in there too, where he says, "Maybe I better come back when I'm broke," you know, and then that Abernathy guy who was so fantastic, you know, says, "Oh, we'll keep you unhappy."
Oh yeah,
yeah, we'll leave you unhappy, you know, and that Abernathy, his name is Arvide Abernathy.
Arvide, he was really good.
He was fantastic, and he was such a key character.
Yeah, Sarah's good at solving other people's problems.
Right, right. And I loved, there was this talk that he had with her that was really short, where she was clearly in love with Sky, and he was telling her, "What are you doing? How are you not?" You know, he's like, something like, you know, she's saying, "I'll just get over it." And he says, you know, "Why would you do that? You know, it's the greatest reward in life, you know."
I wrote it down.
Okay.
She says, "I'll get over it." And he says, "Why would anyone want to get over the one thing you hope for from the minute you're born and remember until the day you die?" And she says, "I'll get over it." And he says, "Why? Because it's the greatest reward that woman or man can have on this earth, to love and be loved."
Oh, yeah. See, that's beautiful.
Yeah. And that was, to me, that was the key. You're right. When I watched it this time, I was like, how did I not make that more important this time before now? Because that is the key. That is what we all want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Sky Masterson and Sarah Brown, I mean, it's like the perfect example of two people that make each other more. You know,
yes.
That they're both independent, and they both have this clear path, but they needed each other to be complete. And you know, that was just incredibly well done in this. And I, for some reason on this time, I really saw that.
Well, and I really, because what I really liked is that they each had their wrong conceptions.
Mm-hmm. Both of them.
And as you say, the coming together, bouncing off of each other, made them have to reconsider. And one of the things I liked is it showed two really different personality types having to do that, because Sarah was more like, it was a type I recognize more, which was, you know, you've got your ideas, you're pushing everything into how those ideas work. You know, everything's defined by here's how it fits into this slot. And I was really surprised this time through, what I noticed was that Sky Masterson is very honest.
Mm-hmm.
And he says it like he sees it. And he is much more open and willing to change his ideas.
Yeah, and I
than
love
grapple with the consequences.
You know, you say that. There's one line that I loved, and she called him a liar. And he says, "Lying is not one of my sins."
Yeah.
Yeah. I loved it. And he was right. He was really being truthful.
Yeah, because when they're in Havana, and he's, she's sung her song about, you know, if I was a bell, I'd be ringing.
Mm-hmm.
And celebrating the fact that she's now sees everything from a completely different point of view, and everything's open to her in a way it wasn't before. And he says, no, let me explain something to you. You're just acting like this just happened. He goes, but I only did this to win a bet. Mm-hmm. And there really was a bell ringing while your head was underwater. I mean, he was absolutely honest. And she says, I don't care. It doesn't change the fact that I see everything differently and I'm okay with this. I understand. It's kind of almost, she doesn't say it, but you felt like, if that's what it took to get me here, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And he then says, yeah, but everything's different for me now. I have to think about it. And I can't remember what he said.
Yeah, and he said something like, you know, did they pass some back and forth where she was, you know, do you know what you're doing? And he was like, because I don't.
Yeah.
You know, and it should have been the opposite, right?
Yeah.
And then I love the line that you just mentioned where he said, the bells really rang. They rang to tell us what time it is.
Yes.
You know, and it wasn't magical. This wasn't, you know, but he was confused in that line, right? He was the He was the one trying to explain to her how she should be feeling about things the way that she was before, right? It was like she should have said, those rang to tell me what time it is. That was like her line. You know
right,
what I mean?
Because just listening to you, I'm just realizing how cleverly that was done, because that's the end of their time in Havana. And at the beginning of their time in Havana, she's reading the guidebook about the cobblestones and when the church was built. And he says, what does it say in there about the music you're hearing?
Yeah,
what does
exactly.
it say about the moonlight? Yeah. And he's going, there's more truth here than these facts. And you're right. By the end, he's thrown off. And so he's going, no, wait. And he's falling back on that as in a way it's a protective mechanism, but in another way, he's trying to be absolutely honest with her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is what I really loved about his character.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's why, yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I agree with you. I agree with you. He was totally honest. And the thing that I liked about that phrase is like, he was saying, you've been changed by this experience and you're scaring the hell out of me because I am too. And this was all unintended.
Yeah.
And you should be saying that rang because of what time it is. You know, that's what I felt he was doing there. He was trying to put it back.
Right.
Right.
Because
but he couldn't.
The date line, when he says, we're only here because I bet that I could get you to come on this date. And that's in any normal romance that we've seen like this, that's when she should have gone, I'm totally disillusioned now.
Right. And she should have stomped away. And then they spent the rest of the time trying to get back together.
Right.
But that's not what happened.
And in fact, that's delayed until later when they get back and find out that there's been the crap game has been held in the mission.
Yeah.
And then she suddenly, because she suddenly says, wait a minute, what was that bet for? And it wasn't just about getting her on a date, she thinks. It was about taking advantage of her bigger mission and everybody that she loves. And then the thing I caught was when she goes, is that all that bet was about? You know, was it really just about that? Was it really?
Mm-hmm.
And she's, without saying it, she's like, were you supposed to get me in bed too? I think. And he said, you belittle me. And she says it again. And he goes, you belittle yourself. And he did that a couple times throughout the movie where Skye Masterson would turn it back on her and go, like, if there's any sin in this room, it's not coming from me.
Yeah.
Or any sinful thoughts or whatever. He was, you know, he would hold people to this high standard of behavior, which was kind of funny coming from a gambler.
It was. Yeah. And that harkens back to that scene with when he first went to the mission where, you know, Abernathy left him alone.
Mm-hmm.
And then that whole conversation, which ended up with, you know, hey, I promised to bring you 12 sinners, which is a funny number too, right? You know, I'm going to bring you 12 of them. And, you know,
he
writes his marker on the back of that Isaiah quote, which she had attributed to Proverbs.
Mm-hmm.
And man, it was just so snappy and smart, great dialogue, well acted. It was great.
Yeah.
I just saved that scene.
And that's where you appreciated those kinds of scenes are where you really appreciated the level of acting that was involved to pull you into the movie. And Frank Sinatra he couldn't have sucked me in that way.
No, I don't think he could have. No, I just don't see that. Yeah.
Or Miss Adelaide. I mean, you know, just those two actors together were amazing. Gene Simmons and Marlon Brando. But so let's talk for a second about that mission scene, because the thing that got me was, you know, the best humor is funny because it's true. It's playing off something you know is true. And I was astounded at how many things in a quick time they were playing off of that is stereotypic behavior that you see from religious people. Like when, so Arvide has left and Sky says, why do you have trouble calling me Brother Sky? And Sarah says, we're supposed to be discussing your problem. And Sky says, maybe non-sinners have problems.
Yep. Maybe I should set up missions for you.
Yeah, exactly.
Come in here and, you know, yeah, for all repentance and no sin.
Yeah, because he says, right. You don't believe I'm a sinner. And she says, I'm prepared to believe you're the biggest sinner I've ever met in my life. And Sky says, but you don't believe I want to repent. Is that it? Did it ever occur to you some people could be all repentance and no sin? Mm-hmm. You know, I may start a chain of missions to help your kind. Come, all ye repenters, and let us bring a little sin into your life. And it's that real, she doesn't mean it that way, but she's had no experience of what she's even supposed to be relating to these people about, which is why they're not responding to her. And so it's a really, without meaning it, a hypocritical attitude. It's very judgmental. It's that whole thing that religious people get talked to about all the time.
Sure.
And that Jesus talked about.
Yeah, agreed.
Because she's not sitting down and having dinner with any of those gamblers to see what they're like and show them what she's like. She's just standing out there with the drum and everything,
yelling and pointing
the tambourine. Yeah.
Yeah, and that scene, you know, and they illustrated that very early on where she's out there and this drunk guy comes out of the bar and she points to him and says, you know, you need to stop what you're doing. And he turns around and goes right back in. He's like, I don't want any of that.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, she's just coldly judgmental, right? And that's not inviting at all.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And that scene had
Why would I pick that over that?
Yeah.
Yeah, which is...
And in a sense, it makes me think of there was a really funny part when they're showing the crowd and she's preaching at everybody. And there's some just regular people, bystanders watching, and some woman is unwrapping a sandwich, and she's standing right behind this huge sign that says keep our city clean. And she's throwing the wrapper on the ground and then throwing another wrapper on the ground, and I was like, I'm just thinking, yeah, that's just like Sarah. Here's a huge sign, but she doesn't care about that city.
That's hilarious. That's so funny.
Yeah,
because I remember that scene, and she's that lady was standing next to a garbage can.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right.
It's like she could have just leaned over and dropped it, but she's just throwing that stuff on the ground.
She wasn't even.
And that's funny to connect it with Sarah, because I hadn't thought of that. But you're right.
No, I just when you were talking, I suddenly went, "Oh yeah, it's what you're saying. It's that same thing of if you don't relate to people personally, they're not gonna get it. Mm-hmm. It's the thing of they're on the battlefield against the devil's first line troops, and Sky says, you can't get at the enemy. This mission is laying an egg. Because they're just the end. What are they offering them? Coffee and donuts.
Yeah. That's true.
Mm-hmm. Those people don't want coffee and donuts.
That's right. Yeah. And it is, you know, you can look at it that way too. It's, you know, that's really an us and them situation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Two different philosophies of life. Sarah Brown in her circle and Sky in his. And then somehow they break through the circle and there's a personal connection, and then that opens everything up.
Yeah, and the personal connection comes from something that's really unsavory.
Mm-hmm.
That bet in order to fund the floating crap game.
Yeah.
And the idea that somebody would take the bet up in order to, you know, you're going to have to obviously coldly manipulate somebody in order to make that bet happen, because he's not going to be able to charm her. That's been proven. She's been approached by guys before.
Right.
She's not falling for it. So, and he does then have to extend himself and put himself out there.
You know, there's a moment that I just remembered where, Sky Masterson says, he says, I'll bring you these 12 sinners. And then back and forth. And then, you know, it's like, okay, well, what do you want in your return? You know, where he's saying, oh, this is a business proposition.
Yeah.
And I want to, go to dinner with you. And then her reaction to that was priceless, I thought.
What was it?
She put her hand on her chest and was like fiddling with a button. Is like,
oh yeah,
why would you want that? I just loved it. It was great.
That fiddling with the button thing was supposed to show us that it was deliberate, and it was supposed to show us that she was struggling with letting herself out and be unbuttoned.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. She, cause I like the thing later where he goes, oh yeah, well, we'll go to my favorite restaurant, the such and so. And she goes, right. Where's that? Havana.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they eat dinner in Havana just like anywhere else, he says to her. She's like, Havana? And and she goes, you want me to go to Havana? And he goes, I didn't write this down, but it's like something like, do you expect to get 12 sinners for chicken salad in a tea room?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you have to extend yourself.
Yeah, what are they worth to you? What are they worth to you?
Yeah, what are you going to do?
Yeah. And then in Havana, she loses all her buttons. On her jacket.
Yes, she does. In the big fight.
Yep. It's good stuff.
It's that delicious sweet milk that she's drinking.
Right.
Bacardi flavoring is really good.
Oh, too funny. Too funny.
Doesn't that have alcohol? Just enough to keep the milk from turning sour.
Yeah. Oh, too good.
Well, I also liked the thing that that very brief scene between Skye Masterson and Miss Adelaide when he's delivering the message. Nicely has brought a message from Nathan saying, oops, I can't run off with you tonight. And he says he'll deliver it.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
So that Nicely will then take him to the crap game. And she's talking about, I just want him to, you know, stop this life and get a job, and I want a little house. And he says, I just want him to change. And he goes, change? Who do you want to marry, Nathan or someone else?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, once again, how perceptive that character was of, you're not going to get someone else. You're going to get the person as they are.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not realistic to say, and I mean whether it's religion or marriage, or whatever, friendship, whatever.
It's such a common mistake made by people, you know, in relationships.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, gosh, how many times do we see that? Not just in movies, but
in
life everywhere, you know? It's just like,
yeah.
I thought he would change, or I thought she would change. It's like, really?
Oh, to me, the
so
classic,
sorry for you, because that was just not the right thing thinking, you know?
Yeah, the classic one is, once we have a baby,
oh boy,
everything will be better.
No good.
You're just no, that's going to just emphasize everything, good or bad.
Yep.
Because that's a whole nother person in the equation. It's not like buying a new lamp.
Agreed. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Wild. And then, yeah, we've got to talk about that, the mission scene, the sit down, you're rocking the boat scene. Because, so first, you know, I loved, you know, we mentioned this already, but the prayer scene really, which is exactly what it was, luck be a lady tonight, you know, please let me roll this right thing so I can bring her these 12 people.
Mm-hmm.
And he obviously rolled the right one. Yay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then... but yeah, the scene where they all go in there and they're in the meeting, that was great.
Oh, yes.
Really great.
I was watching
that. And
someone
converted, right?
Yeah, well, the thing I liked, though, is first the general, whoever of the mission, says, now, why don't you testify? Tell us what sinners you are. And I thought, oh, my gosh, this is confession. This is open room confession, but it's confession. And so I like when... Benny, he goes, Nathan Detroit's having to make people confess. He goes, Benny, this is an order. Tell everyone what a bum you are. I went, I like that. That's confession. Tell the priest what a bum you are.
All right. Oh, yeah. What's that guy,
and one of the people,
horse guy?
Yeah, the Harry the horse one. Did you like his confession is, and then when I lost the $1,000 or lost the bet and had to come here, I was mad and I'm still mad. So it was absolutely honest. It was a real confession. I don't like being here right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you
that's
know?
Right. Good stuff.
But now talk to us about the conversion. Come on.
Nicely Johnson. which is a really cool name.
Yeah. How are you doing? Nicely, nicely.
Nicely, nicely, Johnson. Yeah, but he's the one who stands up and to give his testimony, and his testimony is the song "Sit Down, You're Rocking the Boat."
Oh, and, yeah. But he's, and I hadn't noticed until now, he stands up and he says, "This is happening. This just happened right now."
Yeah.
But it was like it was a dream. And I went, oh my gosh, that's an actual internal conversion situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is
the what passengers, makes it great. Yeah. I'm just looking at the lyrics, you know, for all the people
give
said,
us some
sit
of
down,
them.
Sit down, you're rocking the boat. He said, I dreamed last night I got on a boat to heaven, and by some chance I had brought my dice along. There I stood and I hollered, someone fade me. But the passengers, they knew right from wrong. The people all said, sit down, you're rocking the boat.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the devil will drag you under by the sharp lapel of your checkered coat. sit down, you're rocking the boat. So I sailed away on that little boat to heaven, and by some chance I found a bottle in my fist. And there I stood, nicely passing out the whiskey, but the passengers were bound to resist. For the people all said, beware, you're on a heavenly trip. People all said, beware, beware, you'll scuttle the ship. And the devil will drag you under by the fancy tie round your wicked throat. I love it. It's such a good song, too.
It is.
Really snappy. Yeah.
And the way they choreographed they made that room, that mission, mm-hmm. so dynamic.
Yeah.
Just from he's singing and then the people are popping in as a chorus, and so people are standing up and sitting down. And I this time I was watching Frank Sinatra and I was like, it's interesting seeing him be part of a chorus.
Mm, yeah.
He wasn't the star of that scene.
Yeah. He was very good in that scene. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And
everybody,
then the very last thing it says, a great big wave came and washed me overboard. And as I sank, I hollered, someone save me. That's the moment I woke up. Thank the Lord.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, conversion done.
And the next time you see him, it's the wedding scene at the end, and he's wearing one of those uniforms from the mission group.
That's right.
Yeah,
funny. He's a good character.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's Stubby K, I think, is the actor's name.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think, I'm not sure, but I think he was in the Broadway production. A lot of the lesser characters were from the Broadway production.
Right. Yeah, it's so fun when we watch one of these old movies because, you know, there's so many connections.
Oh, yeah.
I really want to, you know, I always intend to follow all these things to the end of the line, but there's just never an end. And it's like Gene Simmons, right?
Oh,
did
yeah.
you know she did a voice of Hannah in Howl's Moving Castle?
You know,
I didn't know that till now.
That must have been the old person's voice when
it
she
must
was
have been, yeah.
old.
Yeah.
And you know, I think I knew that just academically, but didn't connect it with the real person. And of course, she was an actress who was in all kinds of stuff.
So yeah, so some of her really good stuff. I'm just looking back, Spartacus.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
The girlfriend / wife.
So, yeah.
The slave maiden.
Well, she did a movie called The Blue Lagoon, which is not The Blue Lagoon that's famous. It's 1949.
Certainly hope not.
Two children are shipwrecked on it. Oh, wow. So The Blue Lagoon was a remake of a 1949 movie.
I did not
with
know
Gene
that.
Simmons in it. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
I didn't know that either.
Heavens to Betsy. It does not make me want to watch it.
No,
but
no. how about that? 1949.
Yeah, but she was in a lot of, of course, I also, this is wrong of me to do this, but I tend to get her mixed up sometimes with Deborah Carr and the movie she was in too.
Oh,
so,
okay. Yeah.
Not that anybody cares really.
Well, she's fantastic. It was fun.
Yes, she was really wonderful in this. And I was just, like I said, I was just stunned by how lightly but realistically all these different attitudes and points of view were portrayed. And in a sense, I think anybody who's been religious for very long should at least watch the mission part of it,
mm-hmm.
because that's so easy to fall into.
Yeah.
You know? And it's easy to slot people into little places, categories anyway. I mean, we do it with politics. We do it with lines of work. We mm-hmm. do it with all kinds of stuff. And this is kind of a super fun corrective to, you know, you can't do that with people. They've got more to them than you expect.
Yeah, for sure. Very enjoyable. Yeah.
Yeah. Just, yeah. And it's just so much fun to watch.
For sure. Yeah. And before we close today, as a Marlon Brando fan, do you have any movies that you say must be seen? Anything leap to mind?
Well, I haven't sat down and, you know, concentrated on his movies, but On the Waterfront should not be missed.
Okay.
Sometime depending on how many movies we can watch, I hope to watch it and talk about it. It's so good.
Cool. Okay.
How about you? We've watched
Marlon Brando. I've never been a huge fan of his. For me, he's Don Corleone. even watching this movie, it was like, you know, every now and then I would see a mannerism or something like that, and I'm like, yeah, Don Corleone. I have to separate him from Don Corleone.
Well, and I think that's why I liked this movie so much, because mm-hmm. having seen The Godfather and having seen On the Waterfront, those are both, of course, very serious. And this one, you were allowed to see him as a more likable, normal, playful mm-hmm. person. So you could find him as somebody that you might like.
Yeah.
You know, and, cool. and I, that's
well,
why I kind
liked,
of,
I like Don Corleone.
Really? Really? That's interesting.
You know, if he was on my side, I would really love him.
Well, yeah, it's the on my side thing. Uh-huh. His family was terrible, and that's because of him.
All true. Absolutely. Yep. Yeah.
He was the worst father in the world. Well, he thought he was being the best father.
Yeah. And then he played Jor-El in Superman.
I forgot. Well, that was well played.
Yeah.
10 minutes or whatever it was.
Yeah. It's funny how, you know, how did he land that role, I'm wondering.
Well, I know.
Somebody must have really wanted him.
Well, it's funny because Marlon Brando is one of those actors who I'm just not drawn to him. I just don't care about him. Mm-hmm. But whenever I see him, he's magnificent.
Mm.
And so then I appreciate and enjoy his performances, but it's why I haven't seen many of his movies. It's very much the same way as with Russell Crowe.
Hmm.
Not a type that I'm just drawn to, don't really care about him, but I watch him in something and I'm like, wow, you're amazing.
Hmm. That's cool.
Not that I'm saying he's Marlon Brando, but you yep. know.
Mm-hmm.
And don't you have that experience where there are people that you're just like.
Oh, yeah, all the time. Nicolas Cage.
Oh,
I love yeah. him. I love it. You know, I just he has a quality that I just absolutely like, but I don't seek out his movies.
Right.
Trying to think, what's the guy's name? John Cusack is another one that I would put in that category.
Again,
I really enjoy all of his movies, but I never really look for them.
Yeah, when I watch, you're right, those two are the same for me. And when I watch one of their movies, it's in spite of rather than because of them. It's like, oh, I've heard this is so good and, you know, it's got him in it. Okay. But it's not, I'll never go, ooh, a John Cusack movie.
Yeah.
Unlike, now I can't think of somebody. We all know there are
people that you just go see. For me, somebody that I would see just because he's in it is Idris Elba. I just love him. I mean,
he's really, really good.
Yeah, I just right now I'm just like, if he's in it, I'll go watch it.
Mm-hmm. He's so good.
Tom Hardy is one my wife really likes.
Yeah,
so we see almost everything he's doing.
Yeah, same. Well, and it's that, and it won't necessarily make me watch a movie I don't want to watch, but I'll definitely consider movies I'd be on the edge about otherwise.
Yeah.
I'll give them a chance.
Right.
More because of those actors. That's kind of interesting dynamic.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah.
So.
Fun.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for picking that. That was good stuff.
I'm glad you liked it.
I did.
It was one that after I chose it, I went, oh, there's not that much. It's just,
oh, there was plenty.
But there was plenty.
Yeah, for sure.
And also, you kind of feel silly about this one. Of course, it wasn't reading in. It was right. It was sitting right there. But, you know, if a good story is good, there are basic things in it that.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You don't want to read into things, but they're there to be found. So.
Yeah, you bet. You bet.
Yeah.
All right. Well, all right. So next up, in a couple of weeks, we're going to do a book called Slow Horses
by
Mick Herron. So I've got my copy and I'm ready to roll.
My choice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something about spies.
Something about spies.
Okay.
Yes.
That's as much as I know about it at this point. So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's funny because it manages to be a serious spy novel at the same time as this guy writes in a way that you all read lines two or three times because they're just so humorous.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, good. All right.
Okay.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Okay.
It'll be fun to talk about.
You bet. You bet. All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody.
Yes. Thank you. And talk to you in a couple weeks.
You bet. See you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you.